Hello once again to Dr. Sam Jones, veterinarian from my local vet. Hello.
Good morning, Kate.
Oh, sorry. There you go.
Oh, good morning, Kate.
Helps to turn on the right microphone. Sorry about that. I was curious to ask you, we've got a couple of calls. We'll get to those very, very soon, Diane and John, but you're also welcome to call if you're listening, 1300 222 612. I just wanted to ask, first of all, about some broad concepts of pet first aid, and we can, you know, evolve these more as we chat.
Yep.
But I was told that I should know my horse's like baseline temperature and have a way of measuring that so I can tell if he's got a fever or not, and then also know his baseline kind of resting heart rate and be able to kind of know whether that's out of the ordinary or not. Should we know these things about our pets?
Look, it doesn't hurt. Certainly very helpful, depending on the type of animal that you own. So for large animals, very, very helpful, because getting them to the vet clinic is not easy, right? You've got to float a horse. If you've got cattle, it's probably even more challenging. And so to know whether or not something's seriously wrong, it's a great idea if you can get some base measurements. So when you call the clinic, you can say, look, heart rate's this, his temperature's this, what do you think I should do? But for smaller pets, particularly, you know, if you've got, if you're relatively close to a vet practice, in other words, you're not in the outback, then it's probably not as important, unless, of course, you've got a pet with some sort of pre-existing disease. So, for example, if you've got a little dog that's got congestive heart failure, well, it's a really good idea to understand what is the normal resting respiratory rate for dogs, so that you can detect whether or not the dog's actually got fluid on its chest and whether you need to get them to an emergency centre straight away. And so, you know, every time we have a new diagnosis for a dog that's got heart disease, we educate our clients around, okay, what is the normal resting respiratory rate for a dog? Because that is actually the most sensitive marker that you can use to understand whether or not fluid is accumulating in the lungs as a result of congestive heart failure. So that's just one example.
Okay, so it depends on your particular animal. There's a couple of areas in which there's some first aid that you might like to kind of keep in mind if you have a pet. We'll talk through some of those as we go today, but your questions welcome too. 1300 222 612 is the number to call. 1300 222 612. Diane in Brisbane, hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Diane.
What was the question that you wanted to ask today?
I've got a little Havanese. She's about 2.5, and she's got a lot of hair inside her ears. And at the moment, she's shaking her head a lot. I think I'm not sure if she's had water inside her ears when I gave her a bath last.
Oh yes.
But does that hair need to be plucked out?
So it's a good question, Diane, because there's two schools of thought. Well, they're not really opposing schools. It's more like, there's two situations with hair in dog's ears. The first situation is a dog has hair in his or her ears, and the hair does not predispose that particular dog to infection. But if you would pluck that hair, it causes inflammation of the skin, and that can cause a secondary infection, because when the skin is inflamed, it's hot and humid, right? So that's situation number one. The other situation is, a dog that has hair in its ears and that does predispose that particular individual to infection, because the hair kind of traps warm air, creates a nice humid environment in that ear canal. And so in that situation, by plucking the hair from the ear before that ear canal is inflamed and infected, will hopefully prevent, and does in fact prevent, those particular dogs from getting an infection. So it's a case-by-case basis as to whether or not plucking the hair is useful. Now, for your little situation, for your little Havanese, I think that it's important that you have her ears examined, the ear canals particularly, because, if there is an infection, going and plucking that hair would not be the best thing. Well, it would be quite painful whilst it's inflamed. And if you're shaking your head a lot, there's a reasonable chance that there is some sort of yeast overgrowth or a bacterial infection going on, and you want to treat that first and then discuss the options with your vet as to whether or not we pluck to prevent, or whether we don't pluck and we use some sort of ear cleaner to maintain good ear hygiene.
Okay. Mm. All right. That helps a lot. Thank you so much.
Great. No problems.
Thanks, Diane. And why would you say pluck instead of, like, trim?
Oh, you do literally pluck. I mean, you actually get a set of forceps and grasp the hair in these hemostatic forceps. You know, they're quite, and they're like little pliers, and then you just slowly pull the hair out of the follicles.
Super ouchy.
It does sound super ouchy. It's incredible to me how well tolerated it is in dogs that don't have inflamed ears,
but the ones who don't need it.
Well, as I say, some dogs do need it as a preventative,
yes,
but not all. But certainly I'm loath to be pulling it out of dogs that have inflamed ears. I always like to treat the infection first.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes we need to do that sort of treatment, like an ear flush and under anaesthetic, in which case, yeah, we will pluck the hair then.
But why pluck and not trim?
Oh, you can't. It's hard to get scissors
too,
down.
Too far
the
in.
Canal, yeah.
Okay.
Dogs ear canals.
I'm imagining the outside of the fluffy ears, but you're talking about right down deep.
No, I'm talking about the actual tube going right down into the middle ear, and it's quite narrow. So getting a set of scissors in there is tricky, and you certainly wouldn't put a set of scissors in an awake dog's ear. That's too risky.
John in Tully Heads, how are you going?
Yeah, good, thanks.
You're going well, but your deck is compromised, John. What's happened?
I have a neighbour that has a dog, and every time he lets the dog off the chain, it comes straight up to my house, a couple of doors up, and starts urinating all over the deck and all over everything that I've got. I've spoken to the neighbour a couple of times, and then this morning it sort of escalated. He's told me that I should throw a bucket of water over his dog. And I'm just wondering, is there anything I can do?
Well, I would try to prevent. Is he coming up and sort of cocking his leg on the front of your deck? Or is he running up onto the top of your deck and urinating on top of it?
Yeah, up on top of the deck, on motorbikes, cars, urinates everywhere.
Okay. I mean, in an ideal world, you know, you'd prevent access if it was possible, if you could get a fence up or something like that. Now, let's just assume that's out of the question for the time being.
Let's just say in an ideal world, you're able to control where your dog goes.
Yeah, well, that's right. But you can't control other people. You can control your own environment, hopefully.
Yeah.
The next thing I would do... See, the problem with throwing a bucket of water over the dog is that... That requires you to do it.
Yeah, you've got to be there.
You've got to be telepathically
linked to your neighbour a few doors up as to when he's going to open the fence for the dog to get out.
Or you just have a perpetual stakeout on the, you know, right in front of you, sitting on the roof waiting for a dog to run up there. So the alternative to that, and this is sort of what I did when I was training my dog, and obviously I'm talking about doing things that are, you know, within the realms of ethical. Some sort of booby trap. Now, what that might look like is sort of like an alarm that might be triggered by, you know, a laser or something, you know, just a trigger that would just give him a fright enough for him to be deterred. Some sort of adverse experience, you know, that really makes him think, wow, I don't want to do that again. And so, you know, I set up a few little booby traps for my dog, a couple of examples. When he started digging in the backyard, I filled up some little water bombs, you know, the little balloons. I put cayenne pepper in them, and then I blew them up with air, tied the knot, buried them where he was digging, and then, of course, he would dig it, and not knowing that it was there, and it would explode, and cayenne pepper would fly into his face, and he just never did it again. I mean, you know, that's a pretty sort of noxious experience for a dog. And so you could rig up
it's a full balloon. With cayenne pepper in it.
No water, just air, yeah. And cayenne pepper. So when he was digging, his paw would eventually, you know, get down to this balloon, and it would pop, and cayenne pepper would come flying out, and he'd be like, oh, wow, I really don't want to go digging here again. It's not fun. So you could, you know, I think you can set up a little booby trap that might deter him from coming back. Something noxious, but not obviously nothing that would cause pain or any sort of, you know, any issue like that.
That's...
Do you think that would inflame the situation, that if I put cayenne pepper in something and it went on to his dog, and then his dog went home and had, you know, chili burns or something, you know?
Sneezing. Yeah, I mean, they're pretty sensitive to it. You might just find that...
But would it aggravate the owner of the dog?
Impossible to say.
I think you need a neighbour transplant is what I think, John.
Maybe a mediator.
John, I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that the bucket of water situation also helps clean up what's going on. So it's got a that is a double bunger, but that is very difficult because I don't understand how there's a feeling that you should be a neighbour's dog should be entitled to any access onto your property whatsoever. So
yeah, I think the law states you've got to have something like reasonable, adequate control over your dog in public or something to that effect, you know, which might mean on a leash in certain areas. I mean, obviously there's areas that you have to have your dog on a leash, but I mean, even in areas where it's optional, if you, for example, have an aggressive dog, and I'm not saying this one is, but if you did have an aggressive dog, then, you know, the onus is on the owner to have that dog on a leash at all times. So I think that you probably need to go to your neighbour with some information about what his obligations are and say, hey, look, you know, it's not reasonable to expect me to be compensating for your dog getting out and coming and doing this. I think, you know, you need to take better control. Otherwise, I'll have a chat to, you know, the council or whoever the responsible people are.
All in all, John, I think it's a people problem, not a dog problem. But
yeah, that's what I think. But there's definitely no vanilla or something you can spray around that stops them from...
Citronella? They don't. You know,
yeah, you can try citronella.
Spray citronella over the deck.
Try citronella. I'm trying to think. The things that I've used previously are things like they're not really aerosolized, like Vicks Vapor Rub. It's when you know, dogs are licking and chewing things that I've used before. Citronella is not a bad idea, Kate, because they don't like it. I mean, you know, they make those collars out of citronella. Not that I advocate those collars necessarily, but I think in this situation you could try that. It won't hurt your deck, and it might be enough for him to be deterred.
Sorry that we can't really help, John. That's a thorny one.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one last thought on that. I mean, you could get, you know, those mats that you use to discourage pets from jumping up on the couch. They've got like little plastic kind of spikes on them. Nothing that would hurt their paw, but they don't like the feeling of it. Oh. Maybe you could get some of those and put across the access way to that, to the deck. So he actually can't, you know, he'll put two feet on there and be like, whoa, this is like walking on, you know, a rough surface that's uncomfortable on his pads. That could work potentially.
That's if there's not a narrow sort of staircase where you could just block it off and just physically stop it from happening. But John, that's a difficult one, and I do not envy the difficult conversation that will likely come up if you aren't able to find the solution for the dog. Julie and Kaminya, hello.
Hi, how are you going?
I'm really well. What's happening with your pug?
Oh, he's just got a bit of an itchy, constantly scratching and itching, and I've changed his food to non-grain. He's been to the vet before and had ear drops, and I'm just looking for a more, you know, holistic sort of approach to that. And someone had mentioned apple cider vinegar in his water bowl, and I was wondering if there's any truth to that, if that helps, like, calm the skin down or...
I have had one case which was a this dog had extremely red skin, and we were having a really hard time trying to control it with various different, you know, anti-inflammatory drugs that are great for the skin. And the client actually ended up using apple cider vinegar, and it worked, and it was miraculous in how well it did work. So anecdotally, yes, you can use that. I couldn't advise you on a dose because I don't use it myself, but maybe that would be worth a bit of Googling, Julie.
Is it possible to also maybe wet a cotton wool with some water and apple cider vinegar and rub inside his ear, because that seems to be the most aggravated area, or is that dangerous?
We typically will say don't put anything down the actual ear canal, whether it be a cotton bud or anything like that. The only time we, as veterinarians, literally the only time we will ever put anything down the ear is if we have a dog anaesthetised and we're going to flush that ear, or we're actually performing a test where we need to get a sample from the ear canal. But in terms of treating an ear, putting something down the ear canal is very kind of risky and not really typically going to help. Because the ear canal is kind of narrow, putting something down there is just more likely to push things further down. But my bigger concern here with your little pug, Julie, is if we've got a dog that's got itchy skin and an ear issue, that to me would raise the alarm bells that we've got underlying allergy, which, and I know, you know, you said that he's not on a grain diet. In actual fact, grain is not that likely to cause food allergy. Most food allergies are due to the animal protein in the diet, whether it be chicken or beef or lamb. And there is a specific trial you can do with a specific food to rule out food allergy, which is certainly something that we do for a lot of dogs that present with itchy skin and or ear infections, especially if they're recurring. You know, a dog's getting recurring ear infections, that would make me think, okay, there's something underlying here, an allergy that's underlying. But the other possibility for this little guy is he might have a disease called atopy, which is allergy to environmental allergens, typically, you know, allergens that are in the air, like pollens and things like that, and also, you know, cockroach feces or dust mites and all those sorts of things that, you know, humans can get develop hay fever too. So I think that, you know, it's possible that he's got an ear infection. Well, you said he's had got eardrops, so he's got an ear infection, I assume. And I would treat that, and then I would be going down a systematic pathway to try and identify what the underlying allergy is. Because I have a feeling that the apple cider vinegar, if it does work, then great, but it might just come back, you know, as soon as you finish that.
Yep, lovely. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie.
No worries, Julie.
Julie's in Kaminya, and you're listening to 612 ABC Brisbane and ABC Queensland. Dr. Sam Jones is here. He's a veterinarian, and he's been taking your calls. But I'm also curious about the idea of pet first aid, Sam, and some common situations that pet owners might find themselves in where it's handy to know. What do you do? Like, as you take the dog into the vet while you're trying to book or to ease the situation or do the best first aid that you can, what are some key moments where having a bit of knowledge can help?
I think toe toxicity is one that springs to mind, especially living in southeast Queensland. You know, we see a lot of toes, particularly in spring and summer. And the best thing you can do there, even before you put the dog in the car to take her to the vet clinic, and I say dog, I mean cats, I guess, technically can get toe toxicity, but we don't see it as much in cats because they're not as silly as dogs. Typically, they're pretty smart. No offence to the dogs, but the main thing is to get a wet cloth, and wipe out your dog's mouth. It's the toe toxin's typically very sticky, so you want to have that a wet cloth to try and remove by rubbing the gums, remove the as much toxin as you can, then rinse the cloth and repeat. And you're supposed to do that for about 10 minutes. It's quite a long time in a dog that's not having a lot of fun having their mouth wiped out.
So would this be if you've just seen the dog grab a toad, or if they're behaving, what would the toad toxicity look like where you think, oh God, I've got to grab that white cloth, I've got to call a vet, what have I got to do?
Yeah. It would look like, well, one of the hallmarks of toad toxicity is a dog with brick red gums. That's sort of like one of the physical hallmarks, but you'd interpret that in the context of, okay, is it dusk? Has my dog been in the backyard? And has he suddenly started acting weird or salivating or pouring in his face? And if that's the case, then you lift his gum and you look at his, you lift his lip and you look at his gum and you go, whoa, hang on, we've got brick red gums. Just remember that, brick red gums. And if that's the case, then that's when you would start that treatment of wiping out his mouth, assuming that it is a toad. So sure, if you see a dog mouth a toad, it depends on sort of the context. If my dog just went up and just sniffed it and kind of, I don't know, gave it one lick, I wouldn't really jump in there and start wiping it out. But, I mean, you could if you wanted to be really vigilant about it. But certainly if they're pouring in their face, salivating and acting pretty spaced out, that would be when I'd intervene with that. So, yeah, and I guess, you know, one of the other things I think that's good for people to know about, what could you do at home before taking your dog to the vet, let's say it's a dog, that might help, or at least might help you decide whether he needs to go to the vet or not, is dogs that are sort of lethargic or suddenly more lethargic and quieter than they usually are, particularly older dogs, right, and medium to large breed dogs. So, you know, your German Shepherds and those sorts of things, Ridgeback, large breed dogs. A lot of these guys can develop tumours of their spleen. And what can happen is the tumour will bleed, suddenly start bleeding, and they can lose quite a lot of blood into their abdomen. It's not really perceptible to us that their abdomen's filling up with blood, but what they show is that they have then a lower blood volume, so they don't feel, you know, energetic. Mm. And they'll just be quieter. They might still eat and drink, but they just won't be their usual kind of athletic self or whatnot. And sometimes the owners just interpret that, okay, he's maybe just
got a bit tired, ran around too much this morning.
Yeah, you know, he's feeling a bit tired. Let's give it a couple of days. And invariably what can happen is the bleeding will stop. The bone marrow will produce new red blood cells and replenish the lost, red blood cells that were lost into the abdomen. And some of those red blood cells will be absorbed as well. And then sometime later it will bleed again. And typically when it bleeds a second time, it's catastrophic. So all I'm saying is if you have a dog that has this kind of sudden onset of unusual lethargy or whatnot, I would, that's a great time for you to listen to their heart and maybe take their temperature, lift their gum, particularly with a, you want good lighting. You know, I put on a head torch when I'm at work to really assess the gums very well. And if that gum colour is anything more pale than salmon pink, then I'm on the phone. You know, you want to be on the phone and or just get your pet booked in at the vet clinic for assessment that day. Don't leave it till tomorrow. You know, that's what you want to do.
Sounds like it could be a good thing just to, if you've got a healthy dog right now, just double check their gum colour and just make sure you're familiar with that, because that seems like it's a bit of an indicator.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what they teach you at vet school. Look at as many normal, like constantly be looking at animals so that you have a reference point for what is normal, so that when you do see something even slightly abnormal, you're aware of it. You know, you become alerted to it. Yeah. So,
thank you so much to the texter who just mentioned dog bane on the text. I don't know anything about that. So, but it's meant to be repulsive to dogs, according to that texter. So that could be something for John to consider, but obviously do that research on in advance. And Drew just asking about cat behaviour. Drew saying that he has an old, I presume 16 and a half is an old
that's
age
old
for a cat. Yeah.
16 and a half, to, you know, they can live to 21. That's the oldest cats I've ever treated. But 16 and a half is definitely geriatric.
And Drew says that she's just disappeared, can't find her anywhere, not in any of the usual hangout spots. And is that a potential end-of-life behaviour? Do cats have that behaviour where they might go away?
Yeah.
At the end.
The thing is, yes, Drew, that's very sad to hear that that's happened to your cat. The thing to know about cats, they're predators, right? Now, predators know what predation is all about. They know about vulnerability. They know that, you know, when they are sick, they are vulnerable. And so it makes sense that they will go and find somewhere where they're not going to be attacked. You know, this is their hardwired. This is from hundreds of years of evolution. So they're going to go away somewhere where they will be able to be in peace. And not be vulnerable to potential other predators that might attack them.
Sorry to hear that, Drew, but thank you so much for your text. I do appreciate it. And thanks so much to everybody who called and texted in while we've been talking about your pets today, and in particular things that you can do, knowledge that you can acquire to help you out in that first instance. We've got a few other ones that we could talk about, but we might save them for next time. We'll see you in around about a month's time.
Sounds good, Kate. There's just one thing I just wanted to mention, if that's okay, something I'm particularly passionate about.
Yes.
I've got a minute or so. The veterinary industry, unbeknownst to most people, the veterinary industry is sort of suffering from a mental health crisis. And this is sort of born out of, call it the perfect storm of circumstances where, you know, typically we've got people who become veterinarians and nurses because they're empaths. You know, they want to help. They're sort of driven to make things better for their patients and for the owners. We've also got this situation where most owners absolutely adore their pet, and so that when they bring their pet to the vet clinic, you know, they're very vulnerable and they're concerned and anxious.
Sometimes we're not at our best when that happens.
No, that, right. Absolutely. You know, and this is the thing, is that can play out with at face value as anger, resentment, or anything like that, frustration that we, you know, don't have answers soon enough, or whatever it might be. And, you know, you've got your veterinarian that's at the front line there, and they receive that. And so it impacts them a lot. Not to mention there are other pressures on veterinarians, because typically if you're working in a veterinary practice, you don't really have the extra resources to call in a second vet that's, you know, on C ward, for example, in a hospital. And I don't know exactly how the hospitals work, but I imagine there's greater resources there. So as the, you know, with the waxing and waning, or the ebbs and whatnot of workload, you've just got to be able to adapt. And sometimes, you know, it's feast or famine, and you've got all these cases flooding into you, and then other days you're not that busy. And so that can put added pressure on you to try and treat these animals in a timely fashion and still give them the best care. So anyway, there's all these pressures that affect veterinarians. And there's a lovely couple that have created an organisation called Sophie's Legacy. And if you would like to get on to their website, just Google Sophie's Legacy and read a bit more about that situation, that would be great, because they certainly need your help and support. Sophie was their daughter. She was a veterinarian, and sadly she took her own life 2 years ago. And that's all too common in the vet industry. We've got, you know, veterinarians are four times more likely to take their own life than your average person, and twice as likely than any other medical professional. So, you know, it really is very common, and sadly to say.
And the other like point of difficulty that lots of clients don't realise is the way that, because it seems sometimes as though veterinary medicine is so expensive, and how could that possibly be the case? And that can feel, you know, when you're in that moment of crisis, personal. Like I have had people tell me, I took this dog to the vet, it was, you know, had a tick, and the vet was going to charge me this amount of money, and how could they do that? And it's extortionate. But of course, not realizing the influence of the pharmaceutical benefit scheme for human medicine and how much everything is subsidized, that it's really, when you don't have any subsidy for veterinary medicine, the scale is different.
That's right.
And it's, you know, it's not extortion. You know, it's not personal, and it's just about trying to make a business that works, but also being able to care for pets. So that's another point that I've had vets express to me, is this frustration that, you know, if they could make things free, if they could save every animal that walks through the door, if they could see every person who had a pet that needed to be seen, that they would, and that wears on them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so we want to do the best job we can do, and it's just very expensive to provide really, you know, good veterinary services to the community.
So Sophie's Legacy is the name of that organisation. And if you're listening and in crisis, or feel like you just want to talk to someone for whatever reason, it's always good to remember the lifeline number, because it, you know, when you feel that way, sometimes you can feel really isolated. So having somebody to talk to can be a good first step. So 13 11 14 is the lifeline number. I almost mentioned it by accident when I was going off the top of my head when I was reading the talkback number before, but it's a good one to keep on hand just in case. Thank you so much for being here today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kate.
Sam Jones is a veterinarian. He's from My Local Vet, and he's been answering your pet questions today.